We're glad to be here this evening and appreciate each of you for being here. As was announced, we're going to continue our studies in the book of Daniel. Tonight's study will bring us up to chapters 5 and 6. There's not necessarily an immediate connection between the events of both chapters. It's just that the message of those two chapters is so short enough we can cover them both in one study without any difficulty. Daniel chapter 5 has a story of the final Babylonian king and the handwriting on the wall. It's the Bible story from which we get that expression that's commonly used today by people that have no thought or idea of anything that happened in the book of Daniel, that they'll talk about somebody foreseeing imminent doom and they'll say, well, he saw the handwriting on the wall. And that expression is based on the events that are recorded in Daniel chapter 5. The other day I was studying for a different lesson that's for a different time and a different situation, and I just stumbled onto some information about Babylonian history. And this information that I saw alleged that the Babylonian society was a notorious drinking society and partying society. When I say drinking, I don't mean water, of course. I'm talking about heavy drinkers, and that they were known as a society for being wild in their way of living and partying a lot and drinking a lot. And when I saw that, it made me think of Daniel chapter 5, because that's what we find their king doing. As we look here in Daniel chapter 5, beginning at verse 1, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Now, it mentions Belshazzar here, who was co-regent with another man who was a Babylonian king at the same time. It seems that Belshazzar was there in the city of Babylon while his co-regent king was out somewhere in the fields fighting, leading an army. This guy's back at home having a party. It mentions his father, Nebuchadnezzar. The word that's translated father there sometimes just means ancestor. And this guy would have been in the line of King Nebuchadnezzar that we read about earlier in Daniel, the book of Daniel, chapter 2. Probably a grandfather or a great-grandfather of this character here. And it, not only is he getting drunk, not only is he having this wild party, both of which is wrong, but in addition to that, he's calling for the vessels that were taken from the temple of God. Of course, the Spirit of God had left that temple. God abandoned it and turned it over to the devices of the heathens who would come in and destroy Jerusalem. And all that was part of God's penalty against the people of Jerusalem and Judah for turning to idolatry. However, that's not this guy's thought process. This guy doesn't think of that as, well, Jehovah the God of Israel has abandoned that temple and he's no longer protecting it. He's not thinking that at all. He's thinking that Jewish God was trying to protect that temple, and our armies come and destroyed it and stole all the stuff, so therefore our gods are more powerful than their gods. That's the way they looked at it. Now, he's about to get an education that's going to teach him better than that, but that's what he's thinking. So when he goes and he gets these vessels, in his mind, those are vessels that honor the God of Israel. Now, they weren't, because God had abandoned that temple, but that's what they were in his mind. And so he's using those to chug the wine that he's using to get drunk and sing praises to his pagan gods that he thinks beat up Israel's God. And in a simplistic way of thinking, that's his way of looking at it. So everything about what he's doing is wrong. And everything about what he's doing defies the God of Israel. And people that do that typically don't have things work out too well for them, as this guy's about to experience. In verses 5 and 6, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him. so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. Now, how long has it been since you've been so afraid that your legs shook so hard that your knees knocked? That's real fear. Okay, so this guy went from party hardy to this is hardly a party. He's got a troubled state of mind. His thought process completely reversed. It doesn't take God long to fix a problem like what this guy was having. Now all of a sudden, his thought process has changed because here he is hooping it up, honoring his gods, thinking that they shine their favor upon him. And, you know, Babylon was a very secure city with unbelievably thick and high walls. It was thought of as just being totally impregnable. It could not be conquered. And so he's brimming with confidence that I will never fall. I am safe in this palace. And he's gone from that to, oh my word, there's a hand up here floating on the wall writing words that I don't understand. And so with that event, there is this sudden change. You know, pride goes before a fall. And I imagine before I just now said that, a lot of you had already thought those words. And this guy's pride has preceded his fall that he's about to undergo or about to experience. We continue now. He makes an offer. As you go a little further in the chapter, in verses 16 and 17, he does what his ancestral kings did. He calls all the specialists, the soothsayers, the different magicians of the occultic pagan religions that they had together. And he says, in the past they had called to them, but he goes straight to Daniel and asks Daniel. The other kings before him had called all of them together, and Daniel always outshined them. So Belshazzar goes straight to Daniel, and he says, I've heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. I guess Daniel put his boots on first thing in the morning because the guy was brave. I mean, we find him here just really an uncommon courage. Look, you've got the king of the most powerful nation in the world that's offering you all these gifts. And you look at me square in the eyes and say, give your gifts to yourself. I don't want them. But stop and think about it. What was Belshazzar offering Daniel? One third of the kingdom. What's about to happen to the kingdom? The Babylonian kingdom's about to fall. It's about to become nothing. So what's one third of nothing? Now, I didn't always make A's in math, but I know that one third of nothing is nothing. And so when he's offering all this stuff to Daniel, Daniel's refusal is, it's really telling to the king that what you're offering me is useless. You can keep it. Because that's part of the message that Daniel is bringing. So keep your gifts to yourself. I'll read the writing for you. And then Daniel explains what all is wrong. He says, thou, his son, talking about how he was the offspring of Nebuchadnezzar, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thy heart, though thou knewest all this. Now let's stop for just a second. If you were with us for our study of Daniel chapter 4, you may remember that there King Nebuchadnezzar was full of himself, and he's thinking, all this great Babylon is all but the power of my might and me, my mind, and is all about him. And God humbled him and put him out to pasture for a time. And humbled him, and then he came back and realized, you know, nobody has power unless God lets them have power. This isn't me. This is the glory of the Lord that has enabled this kind of thing. And so Daniel is telling Belshazzar, you knew all that happened to your ancestral king, and yet here you are full of pride. Thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the gods of silver and of gold and of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. It goes back to what I said earlier. He's giving all the glory for what he's got to all these pagan gods that are just mythical. They don't exist. They're just a statue, a lifeless statue that can't talk, that can't listen. And the irony is, Belshazzar, you're giving praise to these lifeless idols, and the God who holds your breath in his hand, you won't give him any glory. Instead, you're thumbing your nose at him. You're defiling him. You're abusing these vessels here in, to honor other gods and saying they're better than he is. And so Daniel the prophet is chastising Belshazzar the king for his ungodly conduct. And then he sees that handwriting on the wall, and let's talk about what that means. We come to verses 25 to 28. This is the writing that was written. Meni, meni, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Meni, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now why it says Perez here and upharsin up there, I've never figured that out. But those are essentially the same word or variations of the same word. So Daniel breaks down what he's saying and he says, you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And then he uses a word play to say, your kingdom is about to be overthrown by the Persians. Now stop and think about a guy who's been praising all these false gods and making fun of the true God of heaven. And then a prophet of the true God of heaven comes and says, you have been weighed and found wanting. No wonder his knees were knocking. You stop and think about that. Ought to be a terror to us to think the God who holds our breath in his hand would announce to somebody, you've been weighed and found wanting. You've come up short. What a terror. And that's the terror that Belshazzar experienced. The word Perez here was Parak in Chaldean. And of course, Daniel is in Babylon and they spoke the Chaldean language. And there are places in the Old Testament where, of course, generally the manuscripts are in Hebrew, which was the language of Israel. But there are a lot of places where there's a lot of Chaldean words that are used. And this is one of those instances. Because Israel spent so much time in Babylon, they picked up some of that language. Plus, that was their roots. Abraham was originally from this area. Okay, the word Persia was Perak. Now, of course, I'm putting the English spelling up there to represent the Chaldean word. You understand that they wouldn't have spelled it with our characters. But the idea I want us to look at here is, according to the language scholars, those two words were very, very similar in their look and in their sound. So these are similar words and they would sound very, very similar. And so there's an apparent play in words here that may have pointed to the Persians as the victors over the Babylonians. When he said Perez or upharsin there, he's using a word, the kingdom is divided, but that word sounds real similar to the Persians in their native tongue. So he's explaining that your kingdom is about to be sliced up to ribbons, but he's using language to say that sounds like the name of their number one enemy, the Persians. Now here's a thing for you to think about. And if you enjoy history, I want to encourage you to go back and read in history about the fall of the city of Babylon. It's fascinating. The idea of the Persian army being able to overthrow the city of Babylon was a silly idea. The walls of Babylon were several feet thick. They had no battering ram or no catapult or no military device that could bash those walls down. They were just too thick. Imagine a wall as thick as this building is wide across. And you're going to come at it from the outside and these are giant stones. And okay, you're a soldier. Break through that wall. All you can do is stand at the base of the wall and enjoy archers shooting at you from above. The whole notion of that city that was fully encircled with walls that thick and way too tall for them to put up ladders and climb over the top, what you might imagine, we'll use siege engines, use siege towers. No, the walls were too tall. No nation had the technology to break through, go around, go over anything, those walls. They couldn't do it. But it was right there on the River Euphrates. And there was a rare circumstance there that I'll just tell you part of the story, and you can read more of it later at your leisure. But the generals blocked and diverted part of the river, and it dried up, and they just sashayed right under the walls on the riverbed and just walked in and took the place over. And nobody saw it coming except Daniel the prophet. So what appeared to be impossible, what appeared to be a ridiculous prediction, that Persian army that's been running around out there on the plains of the Fertile Crescent, they're going to come take this city over and destroy it. That just sounded silly to everybody. Well, it didn't sound silly to the guy whose knees was knocking, okay? This guy was taking a different view of things. And so Babylon was overthrown that very night. And it was overtaken by the Persians, just as Daniel had foretold. Just as had been foretold at earlier times in his prophetic memory. Or in his prophetic ministry, excuse me. So this gives you a timeline of the Babylonian Empire and the different kings. Nebuchadnezzar's reign encompassed most of that period of the Babylonian dominance. Remember, there was that period of insanity he had from Daniel chapter 4. It's alluded to here in this chapter. Then there was a period of, looks like that was about 6 years there, where they were ruled by Amel Marduk, Nergal-Sharezer, and Labashai Marduk. And then after that, Nabonidus and Belshazzar ruled co-regent up until the fall of Babylon in 536 B.C. So that lines up the kings, some of which you read about in the book of Daniel, some of which you don't, under the Babylonian Empire. The territory that they controlled is this lighter gray part that you see on the map here, and that was quite a bit of territory. That was a large nation in those times. But understand that though their territory was smaller than some of the other ancient empires, their capital city was more secure than any other capital city in ancient times, so far as I can tell. When the Persians came to power, you can tell that they were spread out more geographically. They sprawled all over the place. You back up to Babylon, a lot of these kingdoms around them paid them money to leave them alone. So those kingdoms were subject to them, but they weren't under Babylonian rule per se. But the Persians, they just went in and forced those kingdoms to submit to their rule, even at times trying to stretch over here into Macedon and Thrace and Greece until they were finally overthrown. And the Persians also enjoyed dominance in northern Egypt. But they didn't have a capital city that was so strong and so apparently impregnable as the capital city of the ancient Babylonians. Now, let's go into Daniel chapter 6. That covers chapter 5. Daniel chapter 6. Here, this is explaining the breakdown of the different governors of the nation that Daniel was a part of. It says in verse 2, over these three governors of whom Daniel was one, the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and the satraps sought to find charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. A lot of these ancient monarchs were fraught with corruption. That's one of the perils of a monarchical government is as you get further from the palace and further from the king, you're out there where the king can't check on you all the time, and he doesn't have any way of checking up on what you're doing. So a lot of the rulers in the outlying regions would be corrupt, and they would skim money from the king's coffers, and nobody was the wiser. Well, the kings knew that sort of thing happened, and so they tried to structure their government in a way that would minimize that kind of graft and corruption. So they would have underlings that would oversee different regions and go out and check and make sure there was no corruption going on. Well, that system sounds kind of good, and maybe it would diminish some of the corruption, but the problem is that system is only as good as the old boys you put in charge of it. But you put a guy in charge of going out here, and you go out here and make sure they're not cheating us and taking part of the tax money. And he goes out there, and he finds that guy taking part of the tax money, and that guy says, here, you want some of it? Guess what's going to happen? He's going to say, sure. And in exchange, I'll keep my mouth shut, and nobody will be the wiser. You keep cheating the king, and I'll get my cut, and everybody will be fine. And so the kings, you know, they lost a lot of revenue that way. They lost a lot of power that way. And it made those large kingdoms like Persia and like Babylon very difficult to rule. But Daniel threw a monkey wrench in the works. He had this thing that's very strange to governmental rulers, if I can just spit that one out. It's called integrity. Now, I know a lot of people talk about integrity, but I want you to focus hard and listen. Some people actually live with integrity. They don't just talk about it. They actually live with integrity. And Daniel was one of them. So if he saw that the pluses didn't line up with the minuses, he'd flag that. And he'd say, king, there's a problem here. So those guys trying to cheat the king, yeah, there's a problem. Here it is in this pile of coins, and solve that problem. And that shut down a lot of that corruption. Well, guess who really likes that? The king. So how well do you think he liked Daniel? A lot. Guess who didn't like that? All the crooked politicians. So to get their racket going again, they've got to get Daniel out of the way, because that pesky thing called integrity and honesty is just kind of holding up our deal. And so you see the setting for what happened here in Daniel chapter 6. They make this plot. Then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to the king, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps and counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Well, that might sound like a strange law to you, but to an ancient Eastern king, Eastern monarch, that made perfect sense. And I'm going to try to explain why. It's really quite simple. In their minds, their king was like a god. Now, he may not have been as powerful as the big gods that their nation worshiped, but understand, in those old pagan religions, it was no problem to have extra gods. You just had as many gods as you wanted. And some may have been more powerful than others, but they were all gods. And so their king was a god to them. And so it made sense in their minds, you don't pray to any other god than this god for 30 days. And then after that 30 days is over, you can go back to worshiping all these other gods you like to worship. But for that 30-day period, you only worship, you only pray to this god, which happens to be your king. So in the ears of that king, with his religious mindset, this Persian king is going to think, okay, that makes sense. But he's not thinking that that's going to snag his old buddy Daniel. Because there sits Daniel with all of his integrity and all of his honor and all of his honesty and all of his refusal to cheat. And that same integrity means when it comes to worshiping God and praying to God, that's not going to change either. Okay? And so the same thing that makes Daniel an honest governor makes him devoted to his God. That's his internal integrity, his faith, his relationship with God. But these guys making this plot against Daniel understand that's the only way we're going to get him. We're not going to find anything to bring charges against him. So we're just going to have to trap him in his own religion. They knew that Daniel wouldn't bend. And so here's what happened. Daniel heard about the writing that was signed. He heard about the law that was issued. And when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. These men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And the king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Now let's notice Daniel's conduct and learn from this. He didn't change a thing. He just kept being Daniel. The day before the king signed that law, he was Daniel. And the day after the king signed that law, he was the same Daniel he was the day before that king signed that law. He didn't put on a show. He didn't stick out his chin. He didn't make a big display of his rebellion. Look at me. I'm going to rebel. This ain't fair. He just quietly went about doing what he always did, serving God and honoring the king. And so his detractors, they've got him trapped. We've caught him praying. You can see him through the open window up there. There he is. He's praying, looking towards Jerusalem. So let's go tattle on him. And you might think, well, why would this be a problem for the king? Why couldn't he just say, oh, well, that's Daniel. We all know he prays to his gods. We'll make an exception for him. Can't do that. Well, why not? Because he made a law that says you can't pray to anybody else. Why can't he change the law? He made it because in their religious thinking, that king is a god. And if he changes that law, that means he made a mistake. And gods don't make mistakes. So to continue to portray and project this idea that he is this divine ruler over the Persian Empire, Darius couldn't afford to say, well, I made a mistake. Let's alter the law a little. So they had that procedure that when that king writes a law, you don't alter it, you follow it. So he's stuck. In the minds of Daniel's enemies, it's checkmate. We do well to learn that with God, it's never checkmate until God says it's checkmate, okay? No device of man can prosper against the plan of God. When God has determined there's something he's going to do, nothing man does can change it. And God had made up his mind about Daniel. So Daniel goes to the lion's den. The king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said to Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. They went through all the paperwork and did everything just like they were supposed to do, put him in that den with those lions and sealed it with a stone. It's interesting that this monarch who thought of himself as a god knew that he was powerless to save Daniel. Must have been humbling for him. Try to imagine from your earliest years thinking that you are a god and then facing a situation where there's someone that you love and someone that you value and someone that you really need and you are helpless to save them. And what does that bring him to? Your God can do it. Which is a sheepish, tacit admission that I can't. He couldn't save Daniel, but he knew what God could. The gods of silver, the gods of gold, the gods, whatever gods the Persians honored, none of them could do anything. But the king of Persia knew who the real God was with the real power. I want to tell you something. A lot of times in life when we think people are being stubborn and they insist on not believing in the true God of heaven, a lot of times deep down people know more about God than we might think. They just don't want to walk with him. Now this king, he may not have wanted to walk with the God of Israel and live according to the will of the God of Israel, but deep down inside when the chips were down, he knew who was God and who wasn't. And he knew that he was a powerless man and that God is the God of heaven and he can save whenever he wants to save. And I'll tell you, the greater we realize that, the better off we'll be. that any power to save is from God. And at the end of the day, we're just mortal man like everybody else, and we need him just like everybody else. So the king was very confident that God would save him. And Daniel was delivered. In Daniel 6, verse 19, it says, "The king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions?" All right, we went from "don't worry, he'll save you" to a question. Did he save you? Then said Daniel to the king, "O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt." Now, I said earlier that Daniel put his boots on first thing in the morning, and here's another example of it. The king that just had him basically put there for execution, only Daniel was spared execution by the power of God. Daniel looks at this king and says, "God save me," because he knew I was innocent and he knew I didn't hurt you. Now that's Daniel's indictment of the king's law and the king's judgment against Daniel. That's Daniel basically in a left-handed way saying, "King, God save me," because he knew you were wrong and he knew your law was wrong. And he knew I hadn't done any real wrong, and so he kept me from getting hurt. You can imagine the kind of guilt that washed over Darius at that moment when Daniel reminded him of his loyalty and his fidelity and his service to the king. You know, Darius had to already be wringing his hands over the thought of losing his number one bureaucrat that saved him from all this graft and all this corruption, and he's going to lose him to these lions because these guys plotted against him. And now Daniel says these words to remind him of what is and of what ain't. But there was retribution. In verse 24, the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. I think there's a historical record, this may be in Josephus, you'll have to check this out, where allegedly on that occasion some of them said, well, the only reason the lions didn't eat Daniel is because they was already full and they didn't need any more food. So they supposedly fed the lions meat at the saying of that and then put those guys in there that had said that, which were the guys that had plotted against Daniel. Now, the Bible record doesn't say that that happened, but what the Bible record shows us is it doesn't contradict what the historical record says. And what the Bible record shows us is these guys got their comeuppance. And it always works that way. Now, it doesn't always work that way in this life, but it always eventually works that way. What you see here in this story is a piece of God's judgment just dropped onto mortal life. The perfect fullness of God's judgment will be revealed after the end of this life. But sometimes in life, God just inserts a drop of his justice. And here's what it shows. These wicked men getting caught in the trap that they set for Daniel. And they got exactly what they deserved. Imagine the terrors of being dropped into a den of lions. And before you ever can fall to the floor, they've got you torn to pieces. And not just you, but you get to enjoy hearing your wife and kids scream as they get torn to pieces before they ever make it to the floor. That fast, that total of a destruction, that is a powerful picture of God's judgment and God's justice. And this shows us that the pure and complete and perfect judgment of God that comes at the end of earthly life, that comes when time is no more, that is the perfect equalizer. And it makes perfect justice out of all that's so wrong in this life. What these guys did to Daniel was wrong. Their accusation that he didn't respect the king was wrong. They were the guys that didn't respect the king. That's not fair. What they did to Daniel wasn't fair. He wasn't hurting anybody. He was just doing his job. And we could go on and on and on and talk about how unfair that is. But you see, at the end of the day, all that unfairness was equalized with just one drop of God's justice in one event. Now imagine how we struggle with the unfairnesses in life. And we struggle with, well, why does this have to happen? And why does it have to be this way? And we get discouraged because we know we live in a life that's broken by sin, and there's problems and there's injustices, and it's just not fair. You stop and think about Daniel in the lion's den, and you remember just one drop of God's justice equalized that situation. How much more at the end of time will God's judgment resolve all that's so unfair about this life? The next time you feel discouraged, the next time you feel like complaining about whatever's bothering you in life, you stop and you think about God's judgment. He's going to make it right when He's ready to make it right. And when He does, it'll be perfect. That's something we can learn from the story of Daniel in the lion's den. So that brings us to our overview of what we've covered thus far in the book of Daniel. We covered chapter 2, where was that great image that I've got broken up and stretched out over the course of time as represented in the book of Daniel. We had the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Greek kingdom, and the Roman kingdom. In Daniel chapter 4, we had the tree cut down and the guy put out to pasture, symbolic of that period of time of Nebuchadnezzar's insanity. That all happened within the time of the Babylonian kingdom. Tonight we've talked about Daniel chapter 5, and that's that handwriting on the wall up there that happened right at the end of the Babylonian kingdom and leading into the Persian kingdom. Of course, the story of Daniel in the lion's den was not a prophecy. It's just an event that took place here within the Medo-Persian kingdom. But Lord willing, when we study in the future and we talk about Daniel chapter 7, we're going to talk about the prophecy there of four different curious or strange beasts. And these four beasts will line up with the four sections of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had in Daniel chapter 2. When you get to Daniel chapter 8, we're going to read about two beasts there, and we're going to see how they fit right within the same columns of time. And then that goat there has the four horns, and then there's a prophecy of 2300 days. We'll talk about all that in chapter 8. In chapter 9, you have the prophecy of the 77s that are reckoned there upon Jerusalem and the temple. And we'll study that from Daniel chapter 9. Chapter 10 is a lead-in to the prophecy of chapter 11 that will split into two studies. It'll talk about the Persian king and then Alexander the Great conquering the Persian empire and his empire being divided into Macedon, Thrace, Syria, and Egypt. And then a lot of Daniel 11 will deal with detailed prophecy of wars within the Syrian and Egyptian division of the post-Alexandrian Greek Empire. Then when we get to Daniel chapter 12, we'll close it off with a study of the vision of 1290 days and 1335 days. And our intention in those is to show you how every one of those prophecies and visions fits within the framework of Daniel as is revealed in Daniel chapter 2. I look forward very much to that study. As we bring our study to a close tonight, I hope you're thinking soberly about God's judgment against sin. And I hope you're thinking soberly about where you'll stand in God's judgment. Why not stand there with Christ as your advocate? If you're not a Christian, become a Christian today and let Him be your advocate to defend you in God's judgment. Let Him plead your cause. If you are a Christian and you need the prayers of the church, let us assist you with those prayers. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and while we sing.